As a non-commercial educational radio station, KZSC supports the free expression of ideas. Please be aware that the opinions expressed are those of the speakers or artists only, and do not necessarily reflect the views of the UC Regents, KZSC staff, management, or underwriters. We welcome your feedback on our programming. Please direct your comments to the Program Review Committee at 831-459-4726 or by email at prc@kzsc.org. Welcome to the Pandemoscene podcast. Today we speak with Dr. Rebecca Dubois, Associate Professor of Biomolecular Engineering at UC Santa Cruz. We ask her thoughts on the many issues involved in developing a COVID-19 vaccine, including the biological details of what a vaccine might look like and be capable of, the necessary phases of clinical trials, and bioethical issues of equity and fairness that will arise during eventual vaccine distribution. Note that this interview was conducted on September 3rd, 2020, and much has changed over the past 2 months, including the U.S. political landscape and breakthroughs in vaccine development.
So what are your kind of opinions on how, just focusing on this country, how can we ensure that, you know, once a vaccine is created, it does get accessible and equitable to people who need it?
So I think that's a really important consideration. It's not just discovering a vaccine that works. The next step is manufacturing enough for the world population. And that is an insanely massive challenge, especially when we don't know what kind of manufacturing facility we need or the reagents and things that we need to make that. And then there's distribution. There's, you know, physical distributing, cold chain meaning having to ship it in freezers all over the world. And then also just getting it, you know, to people that need it. And then finally, creating a priority order of who gets it first. And I actually haven't seen a whole lot of detail on that particular point in terms of who would be priority for the first available doses of a vaccine. I've seen healthcare and high-risk people. That's about as specific as I've seen so far in the news.
Yeah. Where do you think the burden should be placed? Like, who should be deciding these kind of frameworks of who gets access to these vaccines? Because that was kind of one of the questions I had for who gets access to a ventilator. Do we put that burden on healthcare professionals, or do we put that burden on, you know, local governments? How do we put that in the hands of the right people who know how to deal with a big issue like that?
Ultimately, it's going to come down to, I think, governments making that decision for their countries, because it's the governments that are going to be purchasing these vaccines and investing in them. I think one thing that needs to be done is defining what your goal is. Is your goal to prevent death, or is your goal to stop the pandemic and getting the economy back to work? There kind of could be two different strategies for those two scenarios. I would say that preventing death and severe disease should be top priority. And in that case, it would be protecting healthcare workers and then protecting people with the defined high risk features, you know, specifically age or other, high risk factors like obesity and heart disease and things. The reality is once a vaccine is approved, that there's going to have to be some sort of order in terms of priority, and there's not going to be enough for everyone. And so there's probably going to be even stages, not just a first stage and a second stage. And so how that progresses is, to my understanding, not defined yet.
And obviously you talked about how the vaccine distribution will kind of come in stages, because we can't really handle all of it at once. And in the periods between the stages before everyone can get access to a vaccine, are there any potential treatments or other things that people might take advantage of in the meantime? Can we take advantage of pre-existing medicines or treatments to not cure it possibly, but maybe curb the transmission, or, you know, help in recuperation?
Well, there's, yes, definitely. And just, I think in the last few months, we have learned more and finished clinical trials of, for example, the steroid that is able to sort of curb the cytokine response that some people have in response to infection. And so that can decrease death, which is really great. And so that's become a standard of care. There's Remdesivir that had to go through clinical trials and is shown to decrease, you know, the number of days in the hospital and basically accelerate your time to recovery. We know that wearing masks is an effective way to reduce spread. Mm-hmm. So there has been a lot of benefit to sheltering in place and giving time to test these different strategies to see which ones can really mitigate the spread as well as decrease disease and death. And so I think that's going to be the case moving forward. There are many other things in clinical trials, including things called monoclonal antibodies. This is synthetic antibodies made in a laboratory that are injected into a person, and that can provide what's kind of called artificial immunity. Mm-hmm. So again, that's in clinical trials right now and is really has high potential as a preventative and as a treatment. Mm-hmm. So I think there's a lot of things that hold promise to hold us over basically and help us until we get an approved vaccine. And I think the reality is that we need both. We're going to need a vaccine and we need treatments. And it, just like we need for the flu, we need a vaccine, but we also need treatments. Like we have Tamiflu, a treatment that really helps if you take it early.
And that kind of goes into my next question. Do you feel like the goal should be finding a vaccine, or the goal should be instating all of these treatments? Because I feel like from what you've told me, we are treating the vaccine as kind of a be-all end-all. The minute they find a vaccine, the pandemic will be over. And so what are your thoughts on that? And how should we change public opinion that, you know, this might not be the solution that we're looking for?
Right. There's a high possibility that we're gonna, well, I have no idea actually what the possibility is, but the likelihood of a vaccine, some of our one or more first vaccines that are approved, they're not going to be 100%, but that is still enough to really help address this pandemic. And so I do think we should have a lot of hope. And, you know, what we as a world are doing is investing in a lot of different strategies to try and get a vaccine. But the reality is it's not going to work for everyone. And we're still in that situation for our flu vaccines. They work pretty well, but it might depend on how well the strains match, the vaccine strains match the circulating strains, but they don't work as well for older people, and they don't work as well, or, you know, in certain groups, like they don't work as well in obese people and things. So not only do we need a vaccine, but we need to think about vaccines working for many different groups. Mm-hmm. And an important thing is in clinical trials to have the people in clinical trials representing our world, the people, the diverse people in our world, diverse in age, diverse in ethnicity, diverse in body mass index, and a lot of different ways to make sure the vaccine will be effective in everybody.
And, you know, speaking about clinical trials, you think about the kind of pace that we're going at, the normal time period that it takes to develop a vaccine of this caliber and to get it out to people. We are kind of fast railing through that whole process. Do you feel like there are any dangers in doing this and kind of going extremely fast? Obviously, it is needed, but do you think we're going to lose anything in terms of effectiveness, in terms of, you know, health? Is that going to be compromised through, you know, the fast pace of this vaccine development?
I really hope not. The reality is that each, you know, the vaccines in phase three clinical trials right now are in, each one is aiming for 30 to 60,000 people. Mm-hmm. Monitor those. Some people get placebo, some people get the real vaccine. And you monitor and see which one, who is protected. But that's actually 30,000 people is relatively small. We know in history that there's been, I want to say 1976, a flu vaccine was, went through clinical trials. It was shown to be effective. But then once you start, they started vaccinating the entire population, they noticed this rare adverse event called Guillain-Barré syndrome that was like one in a million people. So the chances of catching that rare adverse event is hard to catch in a 30 to 60,000 person clinical trial, but it's just not possible to test a million people mm-hmm. in this phase three clinical trial. So there is always that concern of a rare, you know, unexpected event to happen, even if we get a vaccine that's approved. But at the same time, the risk of not pushing forward to make a vaccine is extremely risky too. And the chance of obviously terrible adverse events of the pandemic continuing through our entire global population, it really will be devastating.
Do you feel like it's going to kind of be, you know, one of those things that we just have to get seasonally every year, a vaccine like the influenza virus, or is it going to be more of, you know, the Spanish flu?
Well, with the Spanish flu, it just went rampant through our entire world and we didn't have a vaccine. So eventually we sort of reached herd immunity. We do know natural infection in flu can provide longer term immunity compared to a vaccine. So that may be what occurred with the Spanish flu. I definitely am not a proponent for the going for herd immunity naturally with natural infection. That is just extremely risky and damaging to our society. But it's possible. Again, coronavirus doesn't seem to mutate as quickly as flu, but it can mutate. So it's not clear yet if it's going to be able to overcome whatever immunity we get from a vaccine. It's going to probably depend on the vaccine and whether the virus can overcome it. There's plenty of cases. For example, our MMRV, our measles, mumps, rubella virus vaccine. You get that vaccine and that the strains cannot, the virus cannot overcome it. Right? It those viruses can mutate, but it just wasn't able to overcome, to have mutations that overcome your immunity and still make the virus infectious. So what would be ideal would be a vaccine that protects against coronavirus and any future mutated strains of coronavirus.
The Santa Cruz Resource Center for Nonviolence is hosting 5 book circles discussing key works on anti-racism, as well as histories of Black and Indigenous people of color in the Americas. The book circles will begin at the end of September. Meeting dates and registration information are available at rcnv.org. Tune in to Now, Hear, This, and explore health and safety topics with the aim of raising awareness and celebrating a mindful contemplation of the mundane. A carefully curated journey through the soundscape of public service announcements, educational materials, and a dash of music representing a different theme each Sunday from 2 to 4 p.m. on 88.1 FM.
One thing we didn't talk about is the COVAX, the COVID-19 Vaccines Global Access Facility. Have you read about that at all?
I actually haven't, no.
So the World Health Organization, CEPI, and then also CEPI, which is Coalition for Epidemic Preparedness and Innovations, and then Gavi, which is a global vaccine alliance. Those three groups have come together and formed something called COVAX. And COVAX is basically an initiative to get global distribution, global and equitable distribution of a coronavirus vaccine. So it's, I feel like it's not in the news enough. It's a completely new thing that sort of emerged, I think, in part from the realization in the 2009 flu pandemic that countries were just individually grabbing up vaccines when they could, mm-hmm. and many poor countries did not have access to vaccines. And so mm-hmm. there was just this global inequity in vaccine access. Mm-hmm. So this COVAX group is aiming to have equitable global distribution of a vaccine should it become available. Mm-hmm. And so it's meant to be a center for countries to buy in, at least at this point. I don't believe there's actually any money buy-in through COVAX, but it's a commitment. And this initiative works with countries and then also works with vaccine manufacturers and distributors to try to basically connect those things. And so right now there's over 170 countries that have, I think, verbally committed to this initiative. And so I think it's a really important and a promising new way to get vaccines to the poorest countries, with the idea that wealthier countries would contribute more than poor countries, but that poor countries would still contribute what they could. And it's sort of, it's almost like COVAX has their sort of vaccine portfolio. And if everyone buys into a number of vaccine candidates, that they will all have a piece of the pie of whatever candidate emerges as a successful vaccine. So I think it's a really great initiative. Unfortunately, just 2 days ago, September 1st, the Trump administration said it would not join this effort. So the U.S. has pulled out of this in favor of the U.S. making its own deals with different vaccine companies. So the U.S. is, you know, really investing in Operation Warp Speed, and the U.S. is individually investing and trying to get commitments for doses from a number of different vaccines. But it's basically decided that, oh, we're going to be on our own and we're not going to contribute to this global initiative. My understanding is that there are like about 80 other wealthier countries that are still committed to this program. And so I think that's really wonderful and is the best chance, I think, at getting the vaccine to poor countries that also need it.
Yeah, that's great. That was one of my questions too. Oh. You knew any like kind of ethical frameworks? I think that is really great that there's an organization independent of countries that won't be influenced by you know financial motivations or anything. Just kind of genuinely trying to get the vaccine out to people who need it the most.
Right.
Yeah, I think that's really interesting.
I'm really hopeful it'll work. Right now, my understanding is that no money has been committed. And so I'm really curious, and I'm going to be following this to see how it progresses and when countries are asked to commit, how many actually do, and what the result of that will be for what the consequence might be in richer countries and how well it'll work for poor countries.
Everyone is just kind of really adamant about, you know, returning back to normal. Do you believe that there is a normal to return back to after this?
Oh, that's a great question. I guess, you know, the reality is probably that there's going to be a new normal. Mm-hmm. I think probably all of us have already started to adapt. I mean, I'll watch something on TV where there's a group of people and they're talking closely and I'm like, oh my gosh, they're not wearing masks, you know? So we're just sort of hyper aware of that kind of thing. But I really do think that once the incidence of disease and infection and spread decreases, likely through a vaccine, that things will return back to normal. Although for sure industries will change, mm-hmm. You know, the number of people probably working from home will stay increased compared to what it was before, that it might be realized in certain places that that's just more efficient, you know, mm-hmm. Oh, this person really didn't need to travel as much mm-hmm. as they had for this job kind of thing. Yeah. So it's sort of forced a lot of industries to just get used to working and communicating online. Mm-hmm. But in terms of just getting back to normal, I think, you know, children in school and interacting socially, I think we are all really desperate for that. And I think as soon as we are able to and feel comfortable, most likely once there's a vaccine, I think people will jump at that opportunity to start being more social again.
Would you have given the same types of answers if we had interviewed you 4 or 5 months ago? Or was it easy for you to kind of, because I understand, you know, you're not focusing on COVID vaccine stuff as like 100% of your research and your lab's research, but you're saying you've initiated a small project or two. Mm-hmm. But was it easy to kind of make the transition to starting that? Or was there a lot of different shifts needed, both technically in the lab and also kind of in your mental works space, headspace?
I guess the biggest thing that maybe I would have had a different response to was in terms of vaccine potential. I just know that preclinical studies of candidate vaccines for the original SARS-1 from 2003, a lot of those vaccines showed basically safety, side effects, you know, potential for enhanced disease. The data from, you know, vaccine development on SARS-1 was not promising and really paralleled some of the work that I've done in respiratory syncytial virus, a virus we've been trying to develop a vaccine for over 60 years. So my perspective on vaccine development for coronaviruses paralleling RSV made me much less optimistic for a vaccine and the safety of a vaccine. But I don't know, it definitely could be the new technologies that are being pursued for a vaccine, for a coronavirus vaccine now. The safety profiles are just they're really good. If there were frequent adverse events or, you know, effects, we would have seen them in like the phase 2 trials and we didn't. So I'm much more hopeful about a coronavirus vaccine than I was in March. So that's sort of probably the biggest change in my perspective since March is the potential for a safe vaccine.
Dr. Du Bois' conversation with us today has stimulated us to think about the bioethical issues involved in developing and distributing a vaccine for COVID-19. We tackled tough questions regarding accessibility, infrastructure, and global health equity. It is important to take these topics of conversation into the dialogues of tomorrow. How can we use the details of vaccine development to inform ourselves about the inequities in global public health infrastructure? How can we link the details of eventual vaccine distribution to frameworks for ethics and justice and not solely profit? We may never have final answers to these questions. However, we must never stop putting our energy into reimagining and reworlding toward a more equitable and just post-pandemic future. Thank you.